Hello, good morning or evening, depending on what part of the world you're in. Welcome to ASPConf. This morning's session is Improving Website Performance and Scalability While Saving Money with Robert Bodegeimer. I would like to thank our sponsors, Microsoft, Telerik, and Component One. They make this possible. With that, I will give it over to the presenter. And we'll get started.
Okay, can you hear me okay? We're going to talk about improving website performance and scalability while saving money. Again, this is Robert Bodegeimer, and that's my Twitter information. A little bit about myself. I've been a web developer since about 1995. I'm a Pluralsight author. I've got my blog address, my email information, and Twitter as well. So feel free after the talk, if you have any particular questions, feel free to reach out to me. So the first place I wanted to start with some basic performance rules. So I've been a web developer, as I said, for a very long time, so into the coding, server-side work. So I always came at performance by the need to try to improve how my code ran. So I always kind of jumped to the conclusion that there must be something in my server-side code. I'm going to go in there and try to figure out what I could tweak to make this slightly faster. It turns out the recent research is actually saying that for most websites, about 80 or 90% of the time that is spent waiting is waiting for the actual page components. So for instance, all of the JavaScript, the CSS, all of those other images and things that we use on our web pages, that's where we actually spend most of the time. So that's what our customers are waiting for. So generally, it's not about optimizing code. So this talk is going to focus more on how do we improve the 80 or 90% where we can get the quick, easy wins to improve performance. Generally, again, it's not about optimizing code. We'll talk about measuring later to make sure that we know what we're solving problems for, but in general, that's true. So again, for the performance rules, we're going to focus on the front end. How can we do the three rules that we have at the bottom? So the things we're going to focus on is we want to make fewer HTTP requests. So a lot of the time spent between the browser and the server is obviously the number of requests I have to make to actually get this page to download as far as images, style sheets, JavaScript. That's going to take a lot of time. We also want to send as little data as possible. So we'll look at compression and other techniques and minification. We want to make the payload that we are going to send as small as it can be. And the last one is send it as infrequently as possible. So our goal is if you come back to my website, you came and visited once, then you go away, you come back a week later, I want you to leverage as much as you can from your local browser cache. I really don't want to resend you the same information from the server again. So again, send it as infrequently as possible. So how do you go about saving and making money? Well, there's really a couple things that performance are going to help you with. It's going to save you bandwidth, and I'll show some examples of what it's done for us in the past. You'll need less servers, ideally, because you're not going to have as much traffic coming into the servers by taking advantage of these techniques. You can also make money, so I put a link on here to some detailed research about both Amazon and Google, what they saw as far as traffic by making really small increases to their performance. So in other words, by cutting off a really small amount of milliseconds on the request from the client, what kind of financial impact that had for Amazon, for instance, how much more they sold. So you can go look at the details of that. But by performing better, your customers are going to be more active on your site, more likely to buy. The other thing to note is Google and other search engines are using performance to determine ranking lately. So that's part of the mix of how you get ranked, if everything else being equal between you and another site, how your site performs does have an impact on how you will be ranked. One of the tools we're going to use throughout the talk is Fiddler. So I want to talk about this a little bit and show some examples of how this would look. Fiddler is a tracing tool that was built specifically for HTTP. So it's made to be very easy to trace the type of traffic you're going to see between your web browser and your web server. It's nice because it shows a complete request and response. So this is not going to get to the packet level like a Microsoft Network Monitor or some of those tools will do. And generally, you won't need to, and I'll show you why. I put a link here to where you can go download it, but I want to show you an example now of some of the things you can do with Fiddler. So I'm going to start Fiddler up, and I've got two versions of a website that we're going to use throughout this particular session. I've got the before version, so we'll take a look at what that looks like. It's a pretty basic site. I've got a header on top, a footer on the bottom. I've got some jQuery here in the middle where I'm doing a slideshow with some images. And I've got a pop-up down here and some sharing links. So let's go look at what we can see in Fiddler. So some of the things we see in Fiddler, we'll see that we've got a number of requests going on here. So when I'm doing a performance review of a site using Fiddler, I'll select all of these sessions first, and I'll go into the Statistics tab. And what I can see is, even though this is a very simple page, it took about 16 requests. After I'm done with this, I'll show you a Microsoft site just to give you an idea. Modern sites typically are more on the order of about 100 requests. So even though you've got one logical page that your customers are going to see, there's actually a lot of traffic going back and forth, and that's what leads to the performance concerns. The other thing to notice here is the bytes received. So this is how much data was sent down to the client. So most web pages today have been topping out at about a meg. You can see this is about 1.5 meg. And as I come in and look through Fiddler, I can see some other things really quickly just by looking. I'm using jQuery, but I can see by the size here that was sent to the client, it's about 250-some K, that I'm not using the minified version. So we're going to talk about minification later, but that's one of the things that'll jump out at us. The other thing I'll notice when I go into inspectors, down here, normally, if the content was compressed, we would see a notification here showing that this was compressed. We can see by the size and the lack of the header here that this is not actually compressed either. And then the last thing I'll notice is these images are really large. I mean, this is almost a third of a meg. Those are way too big to be displaying on a page. But again, that's just a quick introduction to Fiddler, how it works, some of the things I'll look for when I do performance reviews of a site. Let's go look at the same page. What I did is I took that same exact look and feel, that same page, and I created an after version. So if we go into the after, you'll see that it's going to look and behave the same, but if we go and look in Fiddler now, we'll see that there's a number of differences that we notice right away. If I go back to the Statistics tab, we'll see I've cut it down from 16 requests to 11. But the big difference you'll see here is I've cut it from almost 1.5 meg down to about a third of a meg, just by using some of the techniques that we're going to see throughout this particular session. We'll click here quickly and see. You notice here it says it's encoded, so that's my tip-off that it's compressed. And if I look inside this JavaScript, we'll see also that I've got things minified, so we'll talk about that in detail. So again, that's just a quick before and after. Fiddler's a very valuable tool for me to see performance of a particular page or a site. What I'll typically do before I do performance enhancements, I'll actually do a capture. I'll do a file, save all the sessions. I'll save off a before and after version of this. It's good for a historical record for me, so as I make changes to my website, I can see that before I implement a given technique, this is what the measurements were, this was the customer experience. Then I can turn around and do the performance changes, run this again, get another capture, and then I can see the improvements in Fiddler, but I also have historical now. So when I come back, what I tend to do with my own site, about once a month I'll go back to the site with Fiddler, make sure that everything's working okay. It's nice to have that archive from the previous month so I can see are the file sizes about the same, is compression still turned on, things like that. So again, that is a quick introduction to Fiddler. I'm going to clear this and just show you Microsoft's homepage just to give you an idea of a typical modern web page. So as I make that request, you can see I'm already up to about 79 requests here. And again, we can sort by body and things in here to get an idea if some of these pages are particularly large. But that just gives you an idea that typical web pages make a lot of requests. So that's what we're going to focus on today for making improvements. Another really important thing with performance is to make sure that we're doing measurements. So if you've heard the term premature optimization, the idea is sometimes as a developer, again, I would jump in and start looking for server-side sources of slowness. You know, do I not have database indexes? Am I not taking advantage of caching? Some of the other things that I might want to do from a coding perspective. But without actually having measurements in place, I might be changing an area of site that really will have no material impact on my customers. So I don't want to just start applying a lot of techniques without first measuring and making sure that I do or don't have some of these problems. So some of the good places for measurement, I often start with IIS log files. So if you've looked in IIS log files before, there's actually a field in there called time taken. The idea with that is, if anybody from Microsoft is listening, this would be helpful. Time taken, unfortunately, includes the time that my page was in queue, the time it took to execute, and also the time it took to get to the client. It would be really nice if at least the execution and the time to client were in separate measurements. So it would be easier for me to see directly this is how long it's taking to run versus this is how long it takes to download. But today, unfortunately, they're mixed together, but it's still a good indicator for me where I can look at my log files and see that I've done a performance change. I can see how that's impacting my actual customers. So if you've used tools like Microsoft Log Parser, it's a free utility that lets me run queries against my log files. So every day when I get to work, the first thing I'll do, I copy down log files from my production server, and I've got a set of log parser queries that I run against those log files. And one of the things I'm looking for is the time taken. What pages are the slowest? And after I do a move to our website, I like to run these again and see how has performance changed. Did we do anything that made average performance for our pages better or made it worse? A new area that I'm very interested in but haven't been able to take advantage of yet is more real user monitoring. So the idea with this is I want to be able to, I see the time taken I get from my log files. I'm also interested from the perspective of the client. I want to see how long did it take to get the DNS resolved? How long did it take to connect to my server? That kind of information is just being added into browser specs via W3C. So the first one is if you look at the navigation timing spec, you can get information so the browsers can capture things like DNS resolution time, connection time, time to first byte. Those are all things that browsers can capture, and they're going to give a standardized way for me to access that on the client. So using JavaScript on the client, I would be able to access this information and get very detailed timing. Unfortunately, it's not implemented yet in a lot of browsers, so it's pretty early for me to take advantage of on my site, but it's something I'm watching along with the W3C resource timing. This spec focuses on the downloading time for the images, the CSS, the JavaScript. So once this is implemented and used by a lot of the browsers that come to my website, it'll be the first time that in a standardized way, I'll have an easy way to capture that performance data on the client. Then I need to figure out how to transmit it back to my server so I can see how changes that I'm making on the server are affecting my actual customers. Today, what I've relied on instead is what's called synthetic monitoring. So I've used Keynote Service for a long time, and Gomez is very similar. The idea is they set up agents across the United States, in my case, and what it will do is it will connect to my web server every couple of minutes. It'll time a certain page, and it'll keep those records for me. So I can go look at my home page over the period of time and see from the perspective that's closer to what a client would look like, how are things running. I can also break it down by geographic region. So this is one of the primary ways that I get an idea for how is this affecting my customers when I make changes that we'll talk about. So again, the basic idea is we need to make sure we have measurements in place so we know what the actual problem is for our website. So as we're applying these techniques, we know that they're making improvements and that we can see what kind of impact that's having on our customers. So now we'll start talking about some of the specific techniques. So the first one we'll talk about is HTTP compression. So the idea is browsers, most of the modern browsers can handle compression. So the idea is when a web browser comes to the server, it sends along a header in the request called accept encoding. That's what indicates to my web server that this given client understands how to do compression, either gzip or deflate. Then the server can run the code that it's going to run and do a compression before it actually sends the result down to the client. So just like zips, the idea is it's going to take the text files, so my ASP.NET pages, my static files like JavaScript, CSS. I don't want to do this on images because images are already basically compressed. But the idea is when you come to the site then with a modern browser, I'm going to be able to compress the content, which is going to reduce the amount that you need to download. So we turned this on quite a few years ago and measured the before and after. And what we saw was as soon as we turned this on for our static files and for our ASP.NET files, we used 53% less bandwidth. So as our site was growing and we were close to needing to add more bandwidth, we were able to avoid the bandwidth upgrade by taking advantage of compression. So this is one of the examples of saving a lot of money using a lot less bandwidth for my site. Because I had Keynote measurements in place as well, I could see that we were 25% faster on our Keynote measurements. So our homepage was basically 25% faster for everyone who visited because we used compression. So in the past, I had used products before IIS started adding compression. We now use IIS compression. By default, if you use IIS 7 and above, all of your static files, meaning your JavaScript and your CSS, will already be compressed. If you use in IIS 7, you have to specifically set whether you want your dynamic files. So what happens with static files is somebody makes a request, the server looks and sees if it already has a compressed version. If it doesn't, it runs the compression. It'll save a cached version of that, so it doesn't need to run that compression every time someone asks for my JavaScript file. It's just going to do it once. It's going to notice if I change that file and it needs to recompress it. So it's got very limited impact on my server because it's not going to have to do that compression very often. Then when the client comes and says, I understand compression, it can take that compressed version it has cached and send it down to the client. I also turn on dynamic for my website. A lot of our pages are pretty big, and it makes a substantial difference for us to have them be compressed to be a faster download. So I'm going to show you how you can actually set up compression, and I'll show you the before and after again. So I'm going to go into IIS Manager. I happen to be using IIS 7.5. I have a number of websites here on my laptop. So first we'll look at the performance before. So by default, if I open up the compression here, normally this would be checked in IIS 7 by default, you enable. I turned it off just to give you an idea of not using compression at all versus using compression. So let's go back. We'll go into Fiddler. I'm going to clear my cache just so we get a clear view of this. I'm going to go back to my before site. And we'll look at what that looks like in Fiddler. We can see the requests here. And we'll see again that these are pretty large. I want to show you the impact that just compression will have. So again, if I look at this, this is almost, you know, 1.5 meg. To enable it, I simply turn on static and dynamic. I'm going to get a warning here on the right. The only trade-off you're really making by doing dynamic is you're using server-side CPU to do your compression. So this is where it comes back to measuring and testing. Does this make sense for you or not? I've seen some of the studies. It has a pretty minimal impact on CPU typically. So my recommendation would be that if you're really that tight on CPU, you've got other issues. I mean, you need to have more servers at that point that I would recommend you try dynamic, do your testing. Like I said, I turn it on for our site. There are ways in IIS 7 that you can actually throttle. So I can set it up to say if my CPU ever gets above 70%, stop doing the dynamic content compression. So if you are concerned about CPU impact, it is available in IIS 7 and above that you can actually tailor that. So now that I've got that turned on and applied, let's go back and hit that page again. I'll do a Control F5 to force a refresh. Now we'll see that these files are quite a bit smaller. So if I look and select these by doing nothing else, I can see that I've cut my jQuery size. If you kind of look across the different pages here. I didn't do much to the images. That's why overall I didn't decrease the total payload, because again, images are not going to use HTTP compression. We'll talk about techniques for making those smaller later. So let me turn these back off for now. And again, it's very simple to do. It's free. It's built into IIS. When we moved into the versions of IIS, I did a lot of testing with network monitor and packet traces to see if the performance was very good and the amount of compression was very good for what is supplied by IIS. So that's what we use. So there's a lot of benefits to taking advantage of compression. Next thing we'll talk about is content expirations. So we talked about we want to send things as infrequently as possible. So the idea with content expirations are I want to take advantage of the user's browser cache. So if you think about when someone comes to my website the first time, they obviously won't have things in their cache. They need to download all of the files for that particular page. What I want to have, though, is when a return visitor comes back, I want to take advantage of what's stored locally on their own machine. And there's a lot of reasons for this. It's not going to get any faster for this customer than to pull it off their own local disk. In other words, any traffic back to either my CDN or back to my web server is going to take longer than that. So I really want to put some focus on the content that I have provided. How can I designate it in a way that I can tell the browser, please keep this in your cache so that the users can take advantage of that? And the way that we do that is we're going to set expiration times on particular content folders. So I segregate my content. I always split up my JavaScript and my CSS. I don't mix that with my markup, so they're in separate files. I put all of my style sheets in one folder. I put all of my images in another folder, and all my JavaScript in a folder. Now what I can do is I can go set expiration times for this. So what I'm saying with these expirations are, if you come and download a particular, let's say, JavaScript file, I'm going to set an expiration of something like 30 or 60 days, or in my case, I'll tell you later why I do the maximum I can of a year. But what you do is you set that expiration. What that's telling the browser is if this person comes back, it's going to first come to my site, pull down my web page. It's going to look through my web page and see that it needs the same files. Let's say I haven't changed anything. It needs the same files it had before. What it will do is it will look in its local browser cache. If it finds it in its local browser cache, it's going to check the date that it got it. And if I told it it's good for 30 days, it's only been a few days, it's going to pull it right off disk. So ideally, a customer that comes back to my site will only make a request for my page and not have to request any other files. So we talked about how a modern web page today might have 100 requests to satisfy all the images and style sheets. Ideally, a user coming back would only need to make a single request. So you can see the reduction I have in time for my customer. All that load on my server has also been pulled away. Those extra 99 requests don't need to be made. Modern browsers are somewhat smart. If you don't set expiration times, they try to figure things out on their own. But I recommend just being explicit so you know what your behavior is across all of the browsers. So when people first hear about this, one of the concerns is, that's great, but what if I happen to need to change one of my JavaScript files now? Well, what you do, the trick for that is you actually just rename the file. So in other words, let's say I had a JavaScript file called site.js, and I tell you that you can keep it for 30 days. So I know that some people are going to have this in their browser cache. If I had a new version of that particular JavaScript file, if I just simply rename it, what will happen is the users that have it in their cache, they'll come back and get my web page. Now the page will say it needs site1.js. It will look in the local cache. It won't be there, so they'll know that they have to come back and get the refresh file. So I get all the benefits of expirations. All I need to do is rename the file and take care of that. So let's see how we can set some of these expirations. So I'm going to go into IIS Manager again. If I go into my performance after site, it's in kind of an odd place. It's in the HTTP response headers. So I'm going to open that feature. I'm going to say I want to set common headers. And you'll see here it's got expire web content. I can choose to say however many days I want. Or if I knew for some reason my site was going to change on a particular day, it is possible to set a specific date and time. I always use the rolling, for instance, 30 days. And all that means is when a given customer comes, it will set in their browser cache and say, this is good for 30 days. So as we talked about renaming files and stuff, you'll see that's why a lot of the files you'll see now have version numbers embedded in them. I'll talk later about minification and some of the techniques and how we can also get around expirations. But again, expirations are they're very easy to set. It's going to be the fastest possible for your users because they can pull it directly out of their own cache. And you can still get around it if you need to by renaming the file. So I mentioned this briefly, the use of external files. So the idea is don't embed your CSS and your JavaScript directly into your pages. And the reason you don't want to do that is by moving it into separate files, it's going to reduce the page size, which is good. It also allows me to take advantage of reuse. So obviously if I put the CSS or JavaScript directly in my page, I can't use it anywhere else. But the important part is it lets me use expirations. So by moving these out to separate files, I can take advantage of my compression and expirations and know that that will work for me compared to when I place it in a particular file, because I don't put expirations on my actual ASP.NET web pages in my case. So when we talk about sending less and also making less HTTP requests, we'll start talking about bundling and minification. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because I think some of the other sessions go into this in a lot more detail, but I will go through the basics of how this works. So the idea is I want to minimize the CSS and JavaScript files. So by using a minification tool, it's going to go through and remove all of the white space, the comments, excessive semicolons, etc. So it's just going to make the file a lot smaller. The next thing I wanted to do is in order to reduce the number of HTTP requests for my website, I wanted to bundle and combine all of my files together. So on my production site, what I've done, we probably had about 15 different CSS files. I chose to take all of those files, minify all of them, and then combine them into a single CSS file. So the idea is, again, instead of having 15 CSS requests between the browser and the server, I've reduced it to one. And the same with JavaScript. In general, the jQuery library, all of the plugins I use, all of my own custom JavaScript, minimized and put into a single JavaScript file. So I've used some methods before, as far as in the past, and what I still use in production, I use Ajax Minifier and MS Build. So I've got it set up that at build time, when I'm doing a release build, I don't want to impact my developers on their own machine. So when we do a release build, it actually takes, I've got the list of all the CSS files and JavaScript files I want to minify, and then I do the combinations. I've got a detailed explanation of how to do this on an ASP Alliance article. And I've also got some details and examples of this. I have a Pluralsight course that gets into more details about web performance. That's one of the things I show in detail there. The important thing was the technique I set up used free tools, took about maybe 8 hours to implement, and the day we turned this on, our homepage got about 46% faster. So my customers are spending half the time they used to coming to my website just because I take advantage of bundling and minification for my CSS and JavaScript files. So this is one of those huge improvements for us by making a very simple change. So let's take a look at what I'm using right now in this particular technique. I'm using the ASP.NET optimization that's come out recently. It's going to be available for ASP.NET 4.5 and for 4.0. So I downloaded that and I've got that set up here, so I'll show you how that works. So I've got my page, and by default, I just left a comment in here with all of the particular JavaScript and CSS links the way that they used to be. So this would be the way I would code it old style when I'm not doing minification and where I'm not doing bundling. If I look here, using the ASP.NET optimization, what I can do is I can specify that I want all of the files in my JS folder to be minified and bundled together. So with that link, what it's going to do, it's going to look into my JavaScript folder, It's going to take the files that I have, and it's going to do minification and combination of those. And the same with my CSS. It turns out that the particular CSS I had for one of my jQuery plugins didn't work with this minification. There's actually an error in the CSS that didn't work, so that's why I left this one out. But let's go look at what this looks like in Fiddler. So we can see here that I've got the request for the style sheets. Again, I'm still taking advantage of compression. Even though I've minified, I want to do that. And you'll see that instead of being the way the file normally is, it's all been minified, and all of my different CSS files have been combined into a single file. You'll see the same thing here with my JavaScript. Take off the compression, and you'll see that it's done the minification and combination. So again, this has a huge impact. It's not very difficult to implement. I'm looking at here the ASP.NET optimization. I'm looking at when I may incorporate that into our website. The choice I made for ours was to combine all my JavaScript and CSS. The first time you come to my site, you'll get that JavaScript and CSS file. We talked about expirations. I show examples in that article and in the Pluralsight course about how I attach a version number. Because I'm also using expirations, I want to make sure that that combined file has a version number attached. So every time I change it, somebody who comes and visits that has an old version of those files will go get the new version. So ideally, I set an expiration of a year. If you come to my website, the very first page you come to, you're going to have to get those files. If you come back and visit and I don't make any changes to my site, over the course of the next year, you won't need to pull down any of those files. They'll all be available out of your local cache. So in this case, with ASP.NET optimization, they take advantage of doing this at runtime. So I talked about how I did mine at build time, because originally I didn't want to have a runtime impact. This is done at runtime, but I feel better about it because they're caching their results. So as they do their optimization, it's being cached, so it's not rerunning this minification and bundling for every request people are making. By default, the ASP.NET optimization is smart enough to understand that it needs common libraries first. So it's going to put your jQuery, it understands jQuery libraries and says, I'm going to have those be first. Then by default, it puts all of your other JavaScript and CSS files just alphabetically. There is a way to customize the ordering of your files. So if it turns out that you need a particular order and the default order doesn't work, it's easy to go into your code and specify specifically, I want to create a new bundle, and I want the files to be specifically placed in a particular order. And the ASP.NET optimization then understands how to do that. The other cool thing they thought of is, obviously because of expirations like we talked about, they have a way to add a hash value to these bundle URLs. So I can still use expirations, and if somebody comes back and I've made a change, it will have a new hash value, so it will download the new file. So let's go look at what that looks like. I'll comment out that, and we'll look at this. So in this case, I'm using the resolve bundle URL. What this is going to do is it's going to add a hash value. So let me clear out what I've got so far in Fiddler. And we'll make that request again. And now if you see, I've got a version number attached to this. So let me zoom in here. You'll see the JavaScript link, and it's added on a hash value of my JavaScript file. So again, people who come back to my site, if I don't change these files, the hash value will be the same. If they've downloaded it before, they'll be able to use that local file. If it turns out that they had a version and I've done an update, that hash value will change. So everybody will get the new version of the JavaScript and CSS, which is what I want. So again, this is one of the best improvements that I've made lately to our website, is taking advantage of the bundling and doing the minification has made a big difference for performance. Another thing to take advantage of is CSS sprites. So again, this is of the flavor of I want to reduce the number of requests between the browser and the server. The idea with CSS sprites is I can take small images on my website, combine them into a single image, and then use CSS to index into that larger image. So let me show you the before and after of this, and then I'll show you how you can create them. In the before version of the site, let me open that up. So in the before version, I've got my page. And in here, I've got the typical links. I've got a Facebook, Twitter, and email. And you'll see I'm just using normal image tags. So if we look at what that would look like in Fiddler, it'll do what you expect. It will make three requests for those particular files. And I'm going to hit Control F5 so I get current. So you can see the three requests, the Facebook, the Twitter. So again, that's three individual requests. Now, it turns out these images are small enough, it's a good candidate to use for a sprite. So I'm going to go back and I'll show you what it looks like in the after version. There's lots of tools that let you create CSS sprites. I'm going to show you a particular website that I've used before. You zip up all the images you want, post it out to this site. It will give you back the combined file. So you can see here I've got my Twitter, I've got my Facebook. What I did when I went to that website, it created a sprite, and you'll see it's now a single image. And they also gave me the CSS I need in order to index into this. So if I look in my styles, in this case what the site does, it says here's the CSS you need, here's my combined image. And if you'll notice, what's different about the three of them is how it indexes into the particular image to show you the correct sub-image, so to speak. So now how I code this page, instead of doing what I was doing before, I'm just going to use span tags. And there's different ways to do this. Again, this worked for me. I've got a span with a class that will reference that background URL and indexes correctly and to pull out the right image. So if we look at what this looks like in Fiddler, I'm just going to hit it again. We'll see that instead of doing three requests in this case, it's doing a single request. So I've cut in third the number of image requests I needed for those. And again, if I look what it looks like, you'll see that all three images are present in a single download, and it's going to use CSS to pull out the right one. So I'll show you one way that you can do this. So out on this spritegen.website-performance.org, I created a zip file. So I went out in my temp folder and I created a zip file that had the images I wanted to put into a sprite, that email, the Facebook, and the Twitter. Now I can come out here and say I want to upload that. I've got a lot of settings that I can play with here. I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through all of them, but I'm going to choose I want it to be a PNG output. Now I can just say please create the sprite image in the CSS. And you'll see it gives me the correct CSS rules to let me reference those images. And then it gives me the actual sprite image, which you'll see here. So it's very easy to do. Again, I don't recommend to use it. I don't use it for my large images. But for small images that do borders and other things on my website, I can combine them all in one. And again, the purpose of this is you want to reduce the number of downloads that are required. So now let's put some focus on images. So the first thing to be concerned about is understanding the right type of images to use at the right time. So I see a lot of people that are using images in the wrong way. So for instance, in general, JPEGs are best for photos. They do the best types of compression. So they understand how photos work, and their compression algorithms are built around optimizing the size for photos. Basically, PNG and GIF are useful for the rest, so logos, things with simple colors. There is a PNG format that can be used for photos, but in general, the compression that it uses is not as good as JPEG. Again, I recommend that if you have a question and you're not sure, the best way to find out, take your image, save it in these various formats, and find out which one looks better and which one is smaller. But in general, that's a good way to do your split to decide which is the right format for me. If you take advantage of JPEG, you can use its compression. And the idea with it is you're going to trade off the size of the file versus the quality. You can often cut size by 50%, I've even seen higher than that, without losing any quality to the customer. So on a web page, they're not going to notice the difference in quality, but I can make the file substantially smaller. So let's take a look at an example. I end up doing this probably every 3 to 6 months. Somebody asks me about this, and I need to prove to them how this works and how it won't degrade quality. So what I've got on this page is a picture from Australia. We've got the cool Sydney Bridge. I've got various versions, so I've stacked them up next to each other at various levels of compression. So what you can see, there's some that are obviously not very good, way too pixelated. But I can see that there's a lot of them that's not quite as good. I can look at these four, and those four all seem pretty close to each other. If I look at this one, this happens to be the original, so this happens to be about 172K. If I look at the one directly below it, it's about 32K. And I'll talk about JPEG Tran in a minute. And here, it's about 47K. Now you'll see some of the numbers I have in the pop-up. Different graphics tools use different ways of measuring quality. This one, for these, happens to use, this was the original. I chose 10% compression, but you'll see I went from 172K down to about 47K. You can notice some slight differences when they're right next to each other, but on a website where that page image is on its own, it's very likely that that will be a very acceptable image. So let's look at how we can do this. There's a lot of different software packages that do this. Paint.net happens to be a freely available paint program, so I'm going to show you how to do it in here. So I'm going to pull up one of the examples. So I'm going to go back to my Performance Before site, look at some of the images. All of these images are rather large. They're about 300K. So let me open up one of these. And what I need to do is I just say File, Save As. I want to choose JPEG. I'm going to put this into another folder so I don't overwrite the one that I have. Now what it does is it comes up and it gives me a nice preview. So what I can see is I can reduce the file size, and as I play with this particular measurement, I can see that originally, if I want a quality, in this case they do the reverse, if I want a quality of 100%, my file is going to be about 233K. If I play with a slider, you can watch on the preview on the right, I can find a spot along here where it's quite a bit smaller. So it's about 1/10 of the size, but the quality is still pretty decent. So I can just play with that until I get the right trade-off for me. Again, even with slight compression, you can see that I've got very big file savings. So I'll hit OK. And then again, all I need to do is put that image into my website. Now I've substantially reduced the size. It's going to save me bandwidth. It's going to make it much faster for my customer. And if you do that trade-off of the quality and size correctly, they'll never know the difference. So that's another easy win. And today, now that most people are doing minifications, a lot of people are doing bundling, they're using compression, images are kind of the area where you can take advantage of making some substantial improvements, because not a lot of people spend time on this type of optimization. Another tool you can use, there's a lot of different image optimizers. I'm going to just talk about JPEG Tran. In the case of JPEG Tran, JPEG itself has a lot of extra metadata that's included with the image. If you own the image yourself, it's a picture that you've taken or created, it's legal for you to remove all of that metadata. So you can run JPEG Tran. It will take out all of that metadata. It turns out that it's a lossless. In other words, this particular optimizer is not changing the quality of what your image looks like. It's going to take out that extra metadata but leave the quality of the image the same. So if I go back to the display, let me pull up my image optimization again. What you'll notice, I just showed you how to do the basic compression. So I got down to 47K. I ran JPEG Tran on that same image to remove the metadata, and it brought it down to 32K. And these two images are exactly the same visual quality. I just went from 47K down to 32K. I have run this on some JPEG that didn't make much of a difference, but in general, a lot of JPEG images, especially if they're small, taking out that extra metadata will make a big difference in the amount of size. So you can see again, I cut off another good amount of size and didn't lose any image quality. Technique that I've just started using is lazy loading images. So it turns out on our website we've got category pages where in the past we've done paging. So you'd see the first 15 products or so. If you want to see more, you can page on to the next pages. We were looking at including this all in one page, but one of the concerns was if we were to show 100 products on a certain page, we would be worried about the fact that even though most people may not scroll down, your browser's going to have to download 100 images. So I found a jQuery plugin that allowed me to make just slightly modified HTML. And what it does is, as the user scrolls down their window, this jQuery plugin is watching the scroll. It's seeing that you're close to having an image come in above the fold, and it actually dynamically then goes and makes the request for the image at that time. So if people come to my site, look at the first 15 images, those are downloaded right away. If they don't happen to scroll, I don't have any performance impact on my servers or on my customers. They're not downloading all those other images. However, as they scroll down, it's going to actually make the requests on the fly. So it seems to the user as if all the images were already present, but I don't have to take the performance impact. So let's look at how to do this. So in this case, I've got the images that I had before, and I'll show you what the page looks like. So what happens is, by default, I chose that for most resolutions, these two images would be seen right away. So I left those alone, did the image the way I normally would. Now, I'm local on my same machine, so you won't see much of a delay. But as I scroll down, and again, this is something you'll have to test for your environment, but as I scroll down, those other images are requested. So let me show you that in Fiddler. I'm going to clear the cache, and we'll see how that actually worked. Close that one. So if I go into Fiddler and see what happens, you'll see it downloaded the two first images. It also downloaded a clear image. So I've got a 1x1 pixel image that I put in a place of the other two images, so that gets downloaded as well. Now as I actually scroll, you'll see these other two come into play. If we go back into Fiddler, you'll see that those were then requested. So again, that would be, if you look at this, about 150K that if someone doesn't scroll down, I don't need to make them wait initially to get these, and I don't need to have that load on my servers if they're not actually going to scroll down and see. So if we look at the implementation again, the default images I left alone, they're just normal image tags. The way this particular plugin works is it uses the new HTML5 data dash attributes. So I say data dash original. That's what I'm going to point to the actual image. And then my image tag, I put the source to a really small image. In this case, just a 1x1 clear image. So if you see what happens by default, right away my browser sees these images and goes and downloads them. It sees these two and it downloads the image clear, which is very small. Then I include my plugin and I specify which images I want this to happen to. So on the images I need to do this for, I added this class of lazy load image. So in my ready function for jQuery, I just say I want to do a lazy load. Now what will happen is this plugin is watching and it's hooked into the browser scroll. And again, as it sees these images are going to suddenly come into view, it dynamically takes what's in data-original, puts it into the source, which then the browser recognizes, and it goes and downloads that actual image. So again, that's a nice technique if you have a lot of images on a page, but you're not sure that someone's going to look at them all. You don't want to have that upfront impact. It lets you take advantage of only pulling those down when they actually go and see those images. Next thing I want to talk about is a content delivery network, or a CDN. And the idea with this is they've got a global network of servers that are set up closer to my customers. So for instance, I've got web servers here in Minnesota. If you're a customer on the East Coast, if you were to come back to my website, say for my images, you've got to transfer all that back and forth. If I take advantage of a CDN, there'll be a local server very near the customer on the East Coast. So the idea is when they come and hit my site, they ask for a particular image, it's going to pull it locally from their own server rather than come back to mine. So again, it's geographically closer to the user, so it's a lot faster for the customer. It also offloads the work from my servers. So each one of these edge servers on a CDN, the first time a customer visits, it won't have my image. It'll come back to my server and get it, but then it will store it locally. It will still take advantage of expirations and everything else I want to use, but now all of the requests that come in from clients, once the CDN figures out the closest server to them, it's going to serve that file up. It'll be a lot closer to them. It'll be a lot faster. There's also been a lot of competition in this area in the last years, so the price that you have to pay to take advantage of these kinds of services is a lot lower than it used to be. It's typically used for static files, so we host images. In our case, our combined CSS and JavaScript files we also host on a CDN. I'll show an example of if you use jQuery and some other libraries, you can actually pull those from a free CDN, either from jQuery.com or Microsoft or Google as well. But again, the idea of this is I'm just going to offload the work from my servers and get it closer to my customers. So at the top here, I showed an example of the way I used to do a link for JavaScript. And then I left all three of these in here. If you happen to use jQuery and you want to pull from their CDN, you can just reference it directly from those three locations, whichever one you prefer. And now your customers will come and get it from there instead. A couple advantages. Again, it offloads the work from you. These happen to be free. If the customer has gone to another site that happened to pull also, in this case, from Microsoft, they wouldn't have to download it at all because it might be in their browser cache. One of the concerns I've had with CDNs is what happens if that didn't load properly. So I put a little snippet in here of if it turns out that one of these fails, it's actually going to fall back and load it from myself. So it does happen. CDNs do have issues, just like all of our servers. You want to have some fallbacks so things still work. So let's just look at what this looks like by default. I'll clear this out again. So I've just got a ready function that does an alert just to show that jQuery did load correctly. And you'll see that instead of pulling it from my server, it pulled it from Microsoft.com. So let me make a slight tweak to this. So I'm going to add a 1 just to make this fail. And what you'll see is even though I tried pulling it from there and it failed, the browser figures it out and follows up by downloading it from my own server. So we'll see it did work like I expected. And if I go look, you can see that it failed to download the actual file from Microsoft, but it did turn around then and download it from my own site. So again, you get the best of both worlds. You offload the work, it's free. If it turns out that it doesn't work, you still work, and it pulls it from your own server. In my particular case, I don't take advantage of the CDNs for my jQuery files because we talked about minification and bundling. It was better for me to bundle that with my own, all the rest of my JavaScript files and serve that one file So that combine file I put on my CDN, I pull that all from my own CDN rather than reference it from one of these. It's one less request for me and one less point of failure for my site. But if you want to take advantage of these, you can do that. When you use it for images, what you typically do is instead of doing the image tag the way you used to, you'll often be given a subdomain. So if this were your domain, obviously, you can do a subdomain and call it something like content. So now all of my image references will reference HTTP content and then that particular image file, so that it will now pull those images from my CDN rather than put that load on my server. So that's how CDN works. Again, those we've seen some substantial performance improvements by leveraging CDN. So our images, CSS, JavaScript, I did some recent testing with and without, and it's a substantial performance improvement to take advantage of a CDN. So if it works in your situation and you can get the costs low enough, it's a very good technique for improving performance. Next thing we'll talk about is some of the tools available for you. So there are a lot of good advice as far as web performance. What they've done is Yahoo created YSlow and Google has PageSpeed. They've tried to implement these rules into tools so that you can run these tools against your website. It'll first give you a score of how you've done, but it will also list out specific things that you could do to improve your website. So they're very handy when you want to do a review of a particular site. So we'll look at the Google PageSpeed. So I downloaded PageSpeed. It's available to me under Tools in the Developer Tools. So you can see I've got PageSpeed here. What I'll do is I'll visit a website, so we'll go to my before version. I'll hit PageSpeed, and I'll tell it to analyze that page. So what it's going to do is it's going to go run its score. So you can see I got a 71 out of 100. And it will list for me over here on the left things that are high priority that I should focus on. And we've already talked about these two. So it noticed that I didn't have compression on my static files, that I should minify my JavaScript. Again, this is my before version, so I wasn't doing that. It noticed that I didn't have my images optimized, and it noticed that I wasn't taking advantage of expiration. So again, the things we've talked about are high priority, medium priority for a website, and this tool immediately noticed that I did not have those things properly set up. If I look at the after version and do an analyze of that, you'll see I've scored a 91 out of 100. So now I've got no high priority or medium priority. I've got some other things down here. Sometimes the tool will notice some things. You know, it says that I should optimize images. If I click, it can go into details about how I could potentially tweak one of my images just a little more. Some of that for me is a trade-off of what is the visual quality versus the savings. So I may not agree with the tool that I want to squeeze that little bit more out because I think it loses visual quality. But again, PageSpeed and YSlow are just a very good way for me to get a good feeling about am I using the proper techniques that are accepted industry best practices for performance. And with a lot of these, if I don't understand what these mean, I can click on a learn more. It will give a lot of detailed information, talk about tools I could use to take advantage of to do my performance improvements. Another thing I could take advantage of is using multiple domains. So the idea is when you connect to a website with a web browser, it will use a number of back connections to go back and download the JavaScript, the CSS, and the images. The idea is by default, originally the spec said that browsers should use 2 back connections. Now most of the browsers have expanded that anywhere from 6 or 8. But that's per host. So for instance, if I were to come to my domain, if I'm only using my regular domain name, I'm going to be limited to those, let's just say, 6 back connections. However, if I chose to use another subdomain and pull some of the images from that other domain, I'm going to be given another 6 connections to my server. So if you think about it, I'm going to get a lot of parallel downloads going on to my browser by taking advantage of multiple domains in my markup. The trade-off is that you need to trade off the time it's going to take to look up that DNS name. So each DNS name has to go through and get resolved. So by adding in more domains, it's going to take longer to resolve the DNS names. I did some recent testing with this with our CDN, and I was using three different domains for images, spreading my images from my homepage across those three domains, and I saw it was about 20% faster. In my case, keeping track of where I wanted to pull the images from to make sure that they came from the same domains, it hasn't been worth the effort for me yet to implement. But again, this is one of those in your environment. If this makes sense, this could make a substantial performance improvement. My warning would be that if you're going to do this, we talked about expirations earlier. If I had a given image, we'll just call it a.jpg, if I had that image and I referenced it from my first domain name, if you came back and suddenly on the server I said, pull that image from the second domain name, what'll happen is it'll look in its cache, not find the file, and it's going to come back to the server. So if you don't do this correctly, spreading your images across these domains, if you don't keep the same image tied to the same domain name, you may actually be hurting yourself. So in other words, when it could have used something that was in the local browser cache already on their machine, it decided instead to come back and get it. So you need to be a little careful if you're going to use this technique that you're using it properly, but I'll show you how you can do this. So in this case, I've got three images, and I'm just showing what I've done is I've created three different subdomains, content, content 1, and content 2. Obviously, on this small of a page with that few images, you wouldn't want to do this at all. But if you imagine most web pages today have upwards of 30 to 50 different images on them, I would take a group of them and spread them out across content, another group across content 1, and the third group across content 2. And again, do measurements, see if this works for you, measure what performance benefits you get versus the extra work you're going to need to do to spread those across your particular domains. Some other ideas, there's a lot more performance. These are kind of the big hitters that have made a big performance impact with not as much work on our particular website. Some other things that you could do, if it works for you, you can sometimes preload resources. So if you know that somebody comes to your home page and it's very likely they're going to go to one of your category pages next, you could actually set up your JavaScript to start downloading some of the resources needed for that other page. Because the customer's looking at this page, while they're reading and doing things on that page, you could take advantage of downloading those other files. So when they go to your next page, those files will already be there. Another thing I'm looking at now is more asynchronous JavaScript loads. So if you read, I've got the comments at the bottom. Typically, you want your style sheets at the top of pages and your scripts at the bottom, because what browsers do is when they hit a script tag, they stop their parallel downloads. So by moving them to the bottom, you let all of your style sheets and images take advantage of your parallel back connections, and then it hits the scripts and does those. If your particular JavaScript, if it works for you, you can take advantage of asynchronous JavaScript loads, so you can basically not have that be part of your normal flow, but as the page is downloaded, then kick off these requests to get these other JavaScript files. Another good thing to do is to make sure you set your width and height on your images. It's not going to make the downloads any faster, but it is going to make the rendering faster for your client. And as I mentioned this, I'll mention one other thing. Don't play with the width and heights to adjust what your image is. So in other words, don't download a big resolution image and then set its width and height to 100 by 200. You're essentially forcing a full download, and it takes that much more time to get a big file, and you're using a local width and height to have the browser scale it down. You're just wasting bandwidth. So make sure that you've got the right size, but by setting the width and height, the browser knows how to lay out the page right away, even before all the files are downloaded. So some quick resources. I've got a Pluralsight course on web performance. You can follow that URL if you're a subscriber. There's lots of good information in there that I went into more detail that I didn't have time for today. A great book, High Performance Websites by Steve Soters. It's a great resource for a lot of these techniques and several others that you can take advantage of on your websites. So I'll look now into some of the questions that we've had. Again, that's my blog address, my email, my Twitter information. If you have any questions, feel free to email me. Please do the speaker rating as well. I would appreciate that. So let's pop over and look at some of the questions. So can the expiration headers be set in the web config instead of IIS? What was the problem with your CSS that prevented you from bundling, and was it relative? Okay, so I'll take the first one. Can you set expirations? I know since IIS 7, a lot of the configuration settings can be done in a web server section in your web config file. It depends on if your administrators allow you to do that. I'm honestly not sure. I would imagine that expiration headers are something that could be placed in web config to control how you do it in IIS. I just haven't done that. If you want to email me, I can follow up and see if that's possible and where that is. The problem with the particular CSS that prevented the bundling, in the case of the ASP.NET, the particular tool they were using for minification, it gives a direct complaint. So if I put that back in and I run it again, it'll show me specifically something in that actual CSS is coded wrong. So in other words, they didn't use a CSS lint or something against it to make sure that it was valid CSS. So the minification, that particular tool said, I'm not going to minify this. So that's why I moved that one out. And the question was it relative image URLs? That wasn't the problem in this case. So the question, is it better to use the CDN for jQuery libraries or use the bundling minification and host it yourself? In my seat for my site, because I was combining all of my JavaScript files into a single file, you can come to my CDN and get everything you need in one shot. I don't take advantage of the CDN for jQuery libraries from like Microsoft, Google, or jQuery. That is one more potential failure point. I don't have control over. I'm able to control if it fails. So if that particular CDN is just not available, I showed you the backup code that you could do to pull it from your own server. That doesn't help when it's slow. So in other words, at some point, the browser will give up and it'll run my fallback. But if they see some slowness, I don't want to deal with one more single point of failure or perf impact on my site. I chose to bundle them all into a single file, serve that from my CDN because it's minified and compressed and everything else. It's going to be fast, so I don't personally take advantage of those. Is there any drawback of using an external CDN for an intranet site? I personally have never done that. I guess it would boil down to I would find it unlikely that your customers on your intranet, that it would be faster for them to go out your proxy to an internet website with a CDN than it would be to pull from your own local network where you've got a fast network. You'd obviously have to measure, but I would be pretty surprised if there was any advantage. I would think your performance would get worse by going out to an external CDN when you're on an intranet site. So while we're waiting for other questions, I do happen to have some Pluralsight 1 week trial cards if anyone is interested. I've got 25 of them I can give away with this talk. So if you are interested in one of those, just email me at robertb@aspalliance.com and I will send you the first 25 people that send, I'll send you a free 1 week trial so you can go see the more detailed talk, and I've got talks on Fiddler and other things as well. But if you're interested, feel free to email me that. When they're all gone, I'll just put a tweet to say that they're gone. But any other questions? Okay, if not, feel free to follow up with me after the talk, either on email or Twitter, if you have any specific questions. So thank you very much. Oh, I got one more here. Can you please move the question manager to show your blog? Okay, yes, I will. Sorry. There you go. So again, thank you for your time, and please do the rating for me as well.